Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Carol Chasky is a forensic linguist who is considered one of the leading experts in the field. Her research has led to improvements in the methodology and reliability of stylometric analysis and inspired research on the use of this approach for authorship identification. She has provided expert testimony in several federal and state court cases in the United States and Canada. She is president of Alias Technology and executive director of the Institute for Linguistic Evidence, a nonprofit research organization devoted to linguistic evidence. Topics discussed include computational linguistics, large language models, expert systems, forensic linguistics, junk science, discourse analysis, and authorship identification. Links to Carol's LinkedIn profile and other resources mentioned are in the show notes. I would like to welcome to the podcast this week Carol Chasky, who has had an amazing career doing a lot of academic, but also not academic stuff, specifically in forensic linguistics. So that's going to be our focus. So Carol, thanks for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, this is going to be so interesting. I am, as you know from my LinkedIn profile, I am marginally associated with the forensic linguistics because I've done a little bit of expert witnessing stuff, which I really enjoyed, I have to say. Unlike most people, I really dig getting up in a courtroom and giving testimony. Like, that's super fun for me.
Yes, I actually agree with you. Have a judge ask you questions.
Yeah.
You know that they are really interested in what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they really want to know. And they don't mind if you have to go into lecture mode and explain something about linguistics. They're right in it with you. And it's just a wonderful experience.
Yeah, cool. I'm glad we share that. So start at the beginning. How did you get interested in linguistics?
Well, I always liked to learn languages. Mm-hmm. So when I was in high school, I loved Spanish. And then when I first went to college at St. John's College in Annapolis, the great book school, I loved Greek. And I liked Greek, ancient Greek, so much that I wanted to major in it. And at St. John's, which is a great book school, there is no major. You take the great books curriculum for the 4 years. So off I went, and I majored in Greek and English at Bryn Mawr College.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed taking the English courses, and because the focus in that major was very much on literary criticism.
Mm-hmm.
How do we evaluate, you know, the aesthetic properties of a text. And I was good at it, you know, but mm-hmm. I also had this nagging feeling that there's got to be something more. This is so subjective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I can trust this. You know, what if you read it like that and I read it like this? And where's the judgment here? Where's the evaluation? Where's the discernment? So those were just nagging questions that basically went underground for a few years while I taught high school and learned that there were kids in high school who didn't know how to read.
Mm-hmm.
And they hid it very well.
Yeah.
Or they didn't hide it and were suffering. And I just thought, I've got to figure this out. So I went back to grad school. I went to grad school at University of Delaware, which had a very good program in the psychology of reading.
Oh, okay.
So I was there for 2 years working in the reading disabilities lab. We were testing people. We were learning how to run different tests. We were learning about the cognition behind reading. And during that time, Delaware was starting a linguistics program, and I thought, you know, maybe this is a language problem.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not all sequencing. You know, I mean, there are people who believe that, you know, dyslexia is totally a matter of, you know, sequencing items. But I kept thinking, maybe it's really a linguistic thing. So I started taking linguistics, during that time, I was also teaching for the English department. I was teaching composition. And again, I was finding, you know, that question of there's got to be something more. Mm-hmm. And the linguistics was really helping me teach composition because I was able to show kids, you know, this is the structure you're aiming for. You know, this is the structure mm-hmm. where you are. You know, how are you going to get from here to mm-hmm. there? And the English department was contacted by some computer scientists at Delaware who were working on a big parser for the Department of Defense. And they wanted to know, did the English department have anybody who could help them figure out the grammar? Mm-hmm. So just by God's grace, the English department sent me over.
Wow.
And I think it was because I had taught grammar in high school, you know, or they mm-hmm. knew that I was interested in linguistics or whatever. But what a great opportunity. I worked with these two guys who were just so fantastic, Ralph Weishedal and Norm Sonheimer. And boy, they were just the greatest. So the parser took about 40 feet of 3-foot-high rolled out paper. Uh-huh. And it was a, you know, augmented transition network.
What time period is this, just to give people or up reference points?
About the mid-1980s.
Okay.
Yeah. So the problem was that they were trying to create a dialogue system where the sailors would type in a question and the back end would parse the question, go and find the answer, and then bring it back. But the problem was that the sailors would type in really natural language.
Of course.
Actually.
Yeah.
So in some dialects, for instance, in English, there is always singular, no matter what is coming after it. So there's paint boxes, paint pails in the garage is fine in some dialects, not mm-hmm, fine in other mm-hmm, dialects. Mm-hmm. No, you have to go, there are paint pails, because pail is now plural, so the verb has to be plural, and that will make there plural. Well, there were lots of little examples like that, but what was interesting is that the parser didn't crash right away. The parser would be, you know, halfway down the 40-foot paper until it crashed. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it so difficult for them to understand, you know, what was really happening. So I would study the errors that were being made, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. when the crash was coming, you know, and that's when I realized, oh, this is because the parser has this really pristine dialect, as people were wont to do in those mm-hmm, days, you know, mm-hmm. build these beautiful parsers. And so I started calling it, you know, parsing really natural language. Mm-hmm. It is not quite the same as parsing natural language. So we developed a way of relaxing the rules that the parser was built on, and we called them meta rules. It was so interesting because around the same time, head-driven phrase structure grammar, or that time, I guess it wasn't called head-driven yet, it was GPSG, mm-hmm. They were coming up with the idea of meta rules too, rules that would operate on top of other rules mm-hmm. in the system. So it wasn't exactly the same, but it's interesting that we were both coming up with a similar solution to different problems in linguistics. So I built a bunch of meta rules that would relax a really, you know, perfect English parser and make it something that real people could operate. Mm-hmm. And that's how I discovered what computational linguistics was. Mm-hmm. That's when I decided, wow, maybe what I want to do is really study computational linguistics. Mm-hmm. So off I went to Brown.
One thing that I'm seeing overall, you know, in this discussion we're having about theory and what you were doing in this very early form of computational linguistics is still what people are doing in computational linguistics today, right? It's like, yes. how can we make computer understand the yes. way people actually talk? And it's gotten better, but by no means is right. the problem solved. And I think what I'm seeing a lot of people saying, I was just talking about this with some students recently, was that large language models are not understanding language. Like,
no.
And I think because it's gotten so good that it seems like they are,
right.
People make the mistake of thinking that they do. And
right.
It's not. It's what you said. It's parsing. They're just
right.
parsing language and spitting something back at you that matches a pattern that they found in this huge database.
Yeah.
There's no intelligence. There's no reasoning.
Yeah.
And to think that there is the first huge theoretical mistake.
Yeah.
Linguists, by and large, are really good at disabusing people of that notion. Like, you know, Emily Bender is very good about saying there's no intelligence. It's not reasoning.
Right.
So if you understand the task, which is the parsing and the pattern matching, then you're doing good linguistics. But anything beyond that and making claims about understanding or reasoning, or in fact, computers having natural language processing is something of a misnomer. I mean, the natural part of natural language processing is like humans and brains,
yes.
right? It's not computers. So
right.
It can't, like by definition, it cannot.
Right. Yes. Yeah. What it worries me about the large language models, which are now being associated as artificial intelligence,
mm-hmm.
that's what most people think artificial intelligence is. And what is, I think, you know, I'm hoping doesn't happen, is that when large language models fail, which I believe they inevitably will.
Yes, agree.
Because they're really not cut out to do anything useful, that all of AI will go into a winter.
Mm.
So working with the computational linguists and then going off to Brown and then blah, 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 I ended up, you know, building expert systems at one point. And that's really what got me into, you know, or that's really the tool set that I use in forensic linguistics. And expert systems, which are really based on algorithms and rules and meta rules,
mm-hmm.
you know, they can be extremely accurate and very, very helpful forms of artificial intelligence. I'm really concerned that large language models are squashing them. And they're difficult to build. Expert systems are much harder to build than scraping the web and finding out, you know, that eat usually has a noun after it.
Mm-hmm.
because with expert systems, you really have to understand ontology, knowledge mm-hmm. networks, probability, you know, more than what large language models rely on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my take on large language models is, you know, I'm really hoping they won't kill the rest of AI
yeah.
as they commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. And on top of all the things that we've just been talking about, there's the sociolinguistic stuff that gets layered on top of it, which you cannot ignore, right? Like when you were talking about the idea that there are some things that aren't grammaticalized, it really made me think about how people for a long time viewed variations of American English, like mm-hmm. African American vernacular. Like
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have rules, right? It's not regular. People don't know what they're saying. They're just randomly pluralizing or using infinitive, like whatever,
right.
because people did not bother to look at the structure of it, but also the boundaries of class and wealth and all of that stuff that goes into different varieties of English. And I think we're coming out of that now. I see a lot more of that, thankfully.
Well, let me give you a syntactician's perspective on that
mm-hmm.
whole thing, because it's quite different from the way sociolinguists look at it. I know sociolinguists see this as a class and, you know, isolation, social group kind of issue. But to me, what's really happening is that words are far more salient to people than syntactic structures are.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at memory or even like just salience in general, people are very, very perceptive of accent differences.
Mm-hmm.
So sounds are like extremely, you know, salient properties of language. I think right next to that are words. Mm. And that's why dialectologists are always running around saying, you know, do you say hot, hot cake or pancake or flapjack or, you know, because people recognize those things and remember them. But syntactic structures are not memorable. The whole point of them is that they degrade in milliseconds so that you can remember the gist of what was said to you.
Yeah.
You can remember the how, excuse me, the what, but not the how.
Yeah.
You know, you remember the meaning and not the form. So to me, when people were not understanding Black vernacular English as English, I think they were just focusing on the things that we normally focus on in language, which is accents and words, and just being normal lay people, you know, didn't think, oh, gee, I guess there's something syntactic here going on, you know, because we don't even think about it for ourselves.
I think that's right. And I think it's both, right? It's what's happening and also why it's happening. And that's the crucial part of understanding why varieties exist. You know, it's not random.
But I do think that sociolinguistics as a field has really missed out, you know, by not most sociolinguists, you know, you think Berkeley doesn't like Chomsky, you know, most sociolinguists really don't like syntactic theory. Mm. And I think they've really missed the boat, you know, on what's actually happening linguistically, because they're, you know, really concerned. They'll say things that have a semi-syntactic flavor to them, you know, like the use of be for habitual versus not nothing, you know, for not habitual. But that's still like more lexical, you know, they're really not focusing on the syntactic properties of it. Anyway, that's just my footnote on that field.
Well, I think I will say again, I think it's been the result of a huge schism between a lot of linguistics and sociolinguistics. And you know, when I was in graduate school, not that long ago, people still viewed sociolinguistics as not really linguistics. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not serious. You're not being a scholar. This is just fluffy sort of what's in your head stuff. So the field of socio has had to play catch up for a long time. And maybe we're coming to the point where it can be more integrated, I think. But I also think, just from my knowledge of socio, there's a lot of resentment there, right? Like, it, personally, the people who are in it have felt shut out for such a long time. I think there's a little bit of a pushback against wanting to be closer to the areas that rejected sociolinguists for so long. That's just my opinion.
Well, you know, I mean, when I sometimes wonder, like, what happened to that field, you know, that subfield? Because it started out on such a strong footing with Lebeau and, you know, really good experimental designs, you know, strong statistical analysis. But frankly, what I read, especially within the forensic linguistic setting, people who call themselves sociolinguists, they don't do anything like that. I don't know. I mean, there's supposed to be all these, you know, the second wave of sociolinguistics, third wave. And I'm like, wow, well, what happened? You know, because it does come off nowadays that people, especially in forensic linguistics, who call themselves sociolinguists, you know, it doesn't feel like linguistics at all. Usually it's prescriptive grammar, which is really shocking from a sociolinguistic perspective.
Yeah. I will say, I think it depends on what you're seeing. My experience recently has been a lot of really good data-driven sociolinguistics.
Good.
So, there are people out there who are doing it. And, you know, this has been a great meta discussion. Like, I'm really interested in all these things. Mm-hmm. But I want to bring it back to your experience and getting to the forensic linguistics. Like, how did you get there?
Okay, so when I graduated in the time period with my PhD, the time period right before Google.
Mm-hmm.
So there really were not jobs in computational linguistics. And fortunately, my dissertation was in historical syntax. So that made me a little bit more marketable, which is so funny to say now, you know, we can't imagine anybody getting a job in historical syntax, but the computational linguists are all over the place. So I got a job, an academic job teaching. And one of the things they liked about me, with just what Nelson Francis said they would, was the fact that I could teach one. I wasn't married to one particular school of syntactic theory, because I was going to be working with a bunch of socio people and you know, other kinds of linguists. And they didn't really want somebody there who was always like, oh, no, you have to do it this way. I was teaching and I just really didn't like the academic scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be quite frank about it, I felt that the first place I taught, I was teaching PhD students. And I thought to myself, you know, when I graduated, there were 6 jobs in syntax and I was so thrilled to get one. And I'm not sure these kids are going to get one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a little nobody. They're not going to have a big name behind them. And in fact, some of my students I sent to other places because I really felt like, you know, you're too good for this. You need to get somewhere where the whole academic structure can help you. And so I did feel, you know, a kind of moral dissonance with the academic world saying, oh, yes, come and spend all your time with us, you know, and yeah, you'll get a job. Mm-hmm. when there really weren't any jobs. And the academic cycle where people stay like 30 and 40 years in the same position, you know, that doesn't make room for new people. Mm-hmm. There's lots of generations of students who are just not going to get jobs because of the cycle.
Yep.
You know, which, I mean, as you know, we all studied phonology. We should know a lot about the cycle. we should think like that, but we don't, you know? And instead, the academic world is very self-serving in that sense, you know, that it serves those who are in it.
Yeah.
But it does not necessarily serve a search for truth, a search for knowledge, or even a realistic estimate of what can be done with linguistics. So I left that school and I went to another school which didn't have a PhD. And I thought, okay, that'll be better. At least I won't have this moral quandary with me. And as soon as I got there, I was in an English department. And as soon as I got there, the English department wanted to have a PhD. And I thought, oh, can you believe it? You know, none of them had ever worked in PhD programs. I was the only one. Mm-hmm. So I was a super junior person, and I'm the only one saying, do you realize that in order to make this happen, you all will have to start getting grants. You'll all have to figure out ways to support these students. You know, and they were so naive. They had no idea. They just somehow thought the university was just going to pour money in. So I, again, you know, thought I really don't belong in this environment. Mm-hmm. So I was praying, you know, what am I going to do with this degree? And I had friends who had all these ideas, you know, like, why don't you write letters for executives? You know, you're good with words and you could write letters. You know, executives have these hard letters they have to write. And I thought, well, that'd be interesting for about a month. You know, and then by that time, you probably have written all the hard ones, and then you'll just be repeat. You know, it won't be very interesting at all. There's still at that time, this was in the late 80s, there still were not computational linguistic startups. You know, it was a pretty dreary time. And I got this call from a detective named W. Allison Blackman from the Raleigh, North Carolina Police Department. He was in the Major Crimes Unit. And he said to me, okay, I've asked around everywhere, and everybody says to me, I need to have a linguist do this. Mm-hmm. I've got these suicide notes, and I just need to find out, did the dead guy write them or not?
Wow.
And I was like, oh, okay. I've got a toolkit. I know how to analyze language. I know how to run stats. I mean, I'd been, because of my degree in psychology of reading, I was sort of a natural psycholinguist. You know, I had run a lot of experiments on language use and processing. So even though I didn't major in it when I was at Brown. So I said, if you're okay with this being experimental, yeah, I've got some ways to do this. I've got some ideas. He said, yes, it can be experimental. That's fine. I just need to know. This is just a part of the investigation. I need to know.
That's quite an introduction to the field. I'm just kind of boggling that this was the first thing that you got offered. Like, yeah. Whoa, I just, yeah. You know, super interesting, all the things you said, but also the emotional weight of that, knowing what the material is that you're dealing with. Jesus.
Yes. Well, and you know what? The way you get into a field is really going to influence the way you think the field should be. Now, see, I was really fortunate. Because the major crimes unit in that police department had existed for something like 12 or 14 years. In all that time, they only had one or two unsolved crimes.
Wow.
I mean, these guys were just the super sharpest detectives. And they were very sophisticated with regard to evidence. So, see, I learned right at the start, first of all, it was a capital case, you know, that is serious. Secondly, these guys taught me so much about evidence and what's good evidence and what's bad evidence and how you weigh evidence, how you, you know, and they were also really good at keeping all the experts apart. So they wanted no confirmation bias. They didn't want to tell you anything. They told you the minimal, you know, and years later, I saw, you know, I realized, wow, those guys were just the best. You know, when confirmation bias became a real issue in the mid 1990s in forensic science, I was prepared because of those fellas, especially W. Allison Blackman. He was incredible. I remember during that trial, he was on the witness stand, and the judge and the prosecutor said to him, "Why didn't you run a polygraph test on the defendant?" And he said, "Because I knew it wouldn't be admissible evidence." You know, I mean, he said to me, "I don't want to waste my time on inadmissible evidence." You know, it's like, oh my God, this guy's brilliant. You know, he just had such high standards for what he was doing.
Yeah.
And other people who have gotten into the field in a different way, you know, where the case wasn't very serious, you know, it was civil instead of criminal, or they didn't see what they were doing as experimental. They saw what they were doing as a done deal because they were used to lecturing to 18-year-olds who thought everything they said was a done deal. You know, they've taken a very different path in forensic linguistics than I have. So for me, the path has always been about really developing and validating methods. My three things are: the method has to be grounded in linguistics. You know, it can't be what people think linguistics is. It has to be actual linguistics. So when I was talking about, you know, the sociolinguists who work in forensic linguistics, you know, they end up talking about prescriptive grammar. And they've told me, in fact, some have even said to me, well, I do it because that's what people understand, Carol. You know, like, you got to make it, you got to persuade the jury. And I'm like, no, you don't. You got to do good science. Okay. So, and if you're in there under the pretense of having a PhD in linguistics, but then what you do is not linguistics at all. Boy, I thought the moral quandary was teaching kids to get PhDs in linguistics that they couldn't find a job for. Talk about a moral quandary of working in a field where people misrepresent linguistics.
So I just want to, I'm curious to get your opinion about this, because that seems very bad. Do you think that they're doing that because the legal team is asking them to do that, or because they just have this idea that this is what they should be saying?
I think that It's both.
Okay.
I think that one thing is that, yes, the legal teams, you get, I mean, I have worked with some just incredibly fantastic attorneys, okay? But I've also had attorneys that were really not involved, really didn't care about their client, really, you know, were bad news, okay? So for those kinds of attorneys, you know, they want something just easy to understand, you know? And see, there's really two paradigms in forensic science. And a couple of years ago, some friends of mine wrote a really good article, you know, about these two, contrasting these two paradigms. One is called trust the expert. And that's really the older paradigm, pre-1992, but it still exists. And the other paradigm is trust the science.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get people who really think their job is to just come off as some fantastic expert with all these academic credentials, and you just trust me, you know, because I know what I'm talking about, versus the other side of it, which is somebody who has been plodding along, running experiments, testing methods, finding out what does or doesn't work, developing methods that do work, finding out what are the quantity requirements for those those methods, what are the quality requirements for those, you know, I mean, it's all boring. It's all plotting, and, you know, it's not about you as the expert. It's mm-hmm. really about the science.
Yeah.
And that sometimes doesn't seem as glamorous. And unfortunately, you know, there are people in the field who just like glamour, you know, they just like people to look at them.
Yeah, no kidding. I could name several of those. It also just strikes me as a weird path to go down, because as we have seen, I mean, anybody who follows sort of true crime news, I don't mean mm-hmm. like sensationalist podcasts, many, many convictions get overturned, yes. or evidence is thrown out because it turns out that whatever the expert witness was saying wasn't actually yeah. true or wasn't supported by science. I mean, we've seen so many things get relegated to the junk science category. Yeah. And from what you're saying, it sounds like there's definitely a portion of forensic linguistics that could get relegated to junk science.
Absolutely. So when I got into the field, I was kind of like the third generation of people in the field. So the first generation was back in the 1960s with Jan Svartbeck, who recently just passed away, by the way. He was one of our honorary fellows at my research institute. And he was a good friend of Nelson Francis, which was fun, you know, when we first met. So there's that generation. And he was really doing regular, normal syntactic analysis with statistics. You know, it was like, whoa, good stuff. Mm-hmm. But he only did one case, and then that was it, you know. Then in the late 70s, 1980s arose this really trust the expert mentality in forensic linguistics. And then I came along, and I'll tell you why in a minute, why I say that. I came along in early 1990s. So I started working in this field in 1992. Mm-hmm. And about a year or two into it, I said, whoa, I need some funding so that I can actually test what's going on here. Because the first guy, the one who wrote the suicide notes, that defendant got on the witness stand and admitted that he wrote the notes I said he had written. So that was good validation.
Yeah.
Next case I had, again, the guy got on the witness stand and admitted that he had authored the letters that I said he had authored. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, okay, this is either a real fluke or you're on to something, Carol, and you need to start really testing this. So I ended up at the National Institute of Justice, which was the United States Justice Department's think tank. It still exists. And I was there on a visiting research fellowship. And I ended up staying there for 3 years. But while I was there, so this is like, you know, early to mid 1990s, I ran the first test of methods that were being used in forensic linguistics. Mm-hmm. Now, that is pretty frightening. That means that all these guys in the 1980s, mm-hmm. you know, the late 1970s, all through the 80s, they were happily running these consulting businesses out of their academic offices without ever having tested mm-hmm. to see if what they were saying actually worked.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, I have to go back to the junk science stuff, you know,
yes.
Like so much of it from everything that I've read and heard that people get up there as experts and are just saying stuff.
Yeah.
They're just
yeah.
saying stuff.
Yeah. And so when I, the first publication I had on this was in 1997. And then I worked for years thinking, Carol, they must be doing something right. You know, I really wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I really tried. I ran so many experiments, you know, on ground truth data, you know, where I knew what the answer should be. And just over and over and over again, the kinds of things that these guys said they could do, authorship ID, you know, mm-hmm. they could do all this stuff. It just didn't work. It just, mm-hmm. I mean, so I finally published an article in 2001 that, you know, really did shake up the field. I mean, most people were just angry at me, you know, because as a lawyer one time said to me, Carol, you're eating their lunch. And I didn't even know what that expression meant. And I had to say, what do you mean? What does it mean? I'm so stupid. I don't know that expression. He goes, you're taking money out of their pockets. You're, you know, you're blowing the whistle mm-hmm. that this stuff is not linguistics. Most of it wasn't even linguistics. It was just prescriptive grammar. But secondly, even the stuff that had, you know, like a slight semblance of linguistics, that isn't how you could actually detect authorship, for instance, reliably, you know? I mean, you'd be better off flipping a coin.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, okay. yes. There's a lot. I'm sort of processing everything that you're saying. So it sounds like this sort of hardened your resolve to bring science into it. Is that correct?
It did. It was, I mean, and there were really, I have to say, spiritually, this has really been a journey, you know.
Yeah.
It's really hard to be ostracized.
Yeah.
It was really hard to be mocked and ridiculed. But you know what what really helped me was something that Mahatma Gandhi said. He said, well, first they ignore you. Mm-hmm. Then they mock you. You know, they laugh at you. Then they hate you. And then you win. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I have said to myself for all these decades, you know, that, yeah, of course, these people are going to make fun of me. And, you know, one time a big controversy was that I had never been tenured. I said, no, I never, I left. I didn't
get
tenured. I wanted to work in a different field. You know? But it was so interesting to me because, you see, in the academic mindset where most of these forensic linguists live, you know, that's the gold ring. Mm-hmm. Not research. Not having validated
right.
methods, not curating data sets, you know, mm-hmm. doing all the kind of boring plotting stuff that you really have to do this work well.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think that is a thing that society buys into and academia completely supports it. The idea that if you have tenure, you're magical and anything that you say is the truth,
yes.
as if tenured people would not in fact make up data, for example, as right. we've seen happen in so many
yes.
fields, not just linguistics.
Well,
but
I've seen it happen in forensic linguistics, you know, where in one case of a guy who, you know, he claims he's a sociolinguist and he... we actually had a message that he sent to the secretary of a firm saying, are you sure that this document really belongs to that person? Because I don't think it should. So he was basically telling the person to fudge the data for you know, instead of saying, gee, maybe there's something wrong with my method, or maybe my method has an error rate. So in 1992, this whole concept of error rate came into the legal world through a U.S. Supreme Court called Daubert. And basically, what it really shook forensic science up completely. And because what it said is, you know what, when you guys get up here and testify, I want you to tell me, not about you, the expert, I want you to tell me about your science. How many times does the method just wrong? Oh my gosh. When I was at NIJ, one of my jobs was to help the handwriting people. The handwriting, you know, forensic linguistics came out of handwriting.
Yeah.
The 1980s, 90s crowd, you know, the 70s, 90s, they're all aligned with handwriting at some point. So I ended up working with those guys. And one of the issues which non-scientists can't believe, okay, you know, or have a really hard time wrapping their head around, is that they can ever be wrong. And I do think that academia fosters that kind of narcissism, you know, which is really damaging to people. It's sad, you know. But if you're doing normal science, you're wrong a lot.
Well, that's how you learn, right?
Yes. Like, you test this hypothesis and you find out, oh, it didn't predict the pattern, or, oh, it didn't work. I mean, it was like my dissertation all over again. You know, it was, gee, if I say this about pro, then in the government binding world, I'm never going to get what I need to get to be real data. If I say this about I can't remember whether they were phi or theta features, you know, but if I say this about this cluster of features, I won't get case attraction right. So I'm going to have to change the theory because the theory might be wrong. Well, now the really good theoreticians like Ivan Sog, you know, he automatically said, yep, that's, we've figured that out, Carol. You know, we've seen this happen before. And then the new version that's coming out, we've changed that. But for non-scientists, that's a really, really frightening thing. So talk about getting entrenched. You know, it was just like, there are people who, no matter how much empirical evidence you show them that these, you know, certain types of stylistic features do not predict authorship, they just can't believe it. You know, there are people who, no matter how much you show them that words will not predict authorship, they will predict topic. They cannot believe it. They are so entrenched in this one hypothesis that they don't want to be tested on. Yeah. So,
Amazing. You know, I want to keep talking about your career and what you're doing now, but this just brings up for me so many, I feel very emotional about this, and I think people should, because when we're talking about science in courtrooms, it's people's lives, right? And you, as an expert, there's a moral responsibility you have to take. You know, it's not just playing around. It's not doing syntactic theory in the classroom. It's not, you know, moving those pieces around on the board like we were talking about before. It has an actual impact on things. So there's a higher standard that you need to hold yourself to. And I think some people don't get that. I don't know why. Well,
one of the best things that ever happened in my career was, you know the story, of course, of, you know, the Zen story of the father who has a son. They work on the farm. The son breaks his leg. The father is so distressed. This is so terrible. The war breaks out. The father is so thrilled. The son has a broken leg. He can't go to war. You know, you never, just things always work out together for good. So I was called by this guy who said he was going to write an article for the New Yorker. So I talked to him about what I do. And then I I gave him names of all these other people. Well, I was not the star of the article, that's for sure. But some other people that I gave him names of, you know, became the stars. But the best thing that happened over that was a dean of a law school that I didn't know, had never heard, never met, wrote a letter, and it was published in the New Yorker, and said, if the field doesn't go the way Chasky is going, it will someday be responsible for so many wrongful convictions.
That's powerful.
People will be put to death. Yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, I was like, well, thank you, because, you know, the article was not at all what I had hoped it would be. It wasn't at all what it had been promised it would be. It was really focusing on the junk science in the field. Yeah. But thank God that dean, you know, wrote and said, this is dangerous. Junk science is dangerous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, in every way. Let's get back to your career. We're kind of followed, because I want to get to where you founded the Institute.
Oh, okay.
The Institute for Linguistic Evidence, and then also what you've been working on more recently.
Yeah, okay. So when I left NIJ, NIJ wanted to keep funding me. So they said, you have to start an institute, you know, start a research institute so we can keep sending money your way to work on these problems. So that's what I did. So I founded the Institute for Linguistic Evidence in 1998, and it was the first independent research venue in the field. And there's a couple good terms in there. Independent, meaning that we were just testing methods, and research, our focus has always been on research in the field, collecting data, testing data. We don't scrape data off the web and pretend that that's all ground truth data. Never has been, never will be. I'm really kind of shocked that, you know, computer scientists started that trend about, you know, let's scrape all the data off the web. And then we've got all this data. And I'm like, you know what? Those blogs that you think are from 10-year-old girls are actually 30-year-old male cops pretending to be 10-year-old girls so that they can, you know, lure in predators. You know, but that's kind of that whole naivete. You know? We've always been, you know, collecting data. We've collected data with researchers in Spain. We've shared data with researchers in different places. And essentially, we were funded until 2004. And then in 2000, I decided I didn't want to go for grant money anymore. And then around 2009, we were given a big gift. So it's been self-supporting. And then around 2007, I founded Alias Technology, LLC, the software development company and consulting company, kind of to separate out the research functions, you know, from the service functions. And along the way, I've been, you know, building Alias, the software. Alias stands for Automated Linguistic Identification and Assessment System. And it now has about, you know, 20 different functions. These are all tested before we put them into use. The four main areas of it are identification of author, speaker. I'm not a speaker ID person, but we do have some stuff we can do with Alias for that, language. And then the second big area is, what type of text is this? Is it a suicide note or not? Is it a true threat or not? Is it predatory chat? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then the third area is text similarity. So are these two documents similar to each other in ways that they shouldn't be, or ways that they're claimed not to be? So that's a good way to, we handle trademarks in there. We do copyright in that area. And then the fourth area is a linguistic profiling. If you know nothing about the source, can you at least, you know, come up with something about gender, age, education, native language? The best one we can do is native language, native versus non-native. On that, the rest of the stuff is pretty low accuracy. So that's what Alias Technology does. And we're actually Alias also contains two other sections besides this, you know, forensic text analysis. It includes Tatler, which is just a big text analysis set of algorithms. It's multilingual, Chinese, Korean, Russian, English, French, Spanish, you know, bunches and bunches of languages, not all. And that's where researchers can really just use a tool to analyze all aspects of a language. So we go from phonological analysis all the way up to discourse and sociolinguistic analysis. I really tried to build a tool for people that they didn't have to jump from one thing to another. And then it also includes like a whole invoicing, you know, an accounting system. But it's really built for people to have a good practice that includes research. And we've had researchers from all over the world use it for various dissertations or other kinds of projects. The value of my civil cases is way over $75 billion. But I mean, what's really important is having these validated methods. For that's really priceless, you know, having validated methods, especially in criminal cases.
Yes. So at the Institute and also with Alias, do you employ other linguists?
Now only on a contract basis. I mean, there was a point where I had employees, just too difficult to deal with it all. But if I have really big cases, I have, you know, linguists that I trust, that I've worked with. One of the best things that happened to me in my career was I had a case, really huge amounts of data. We were working for a sovereign government, not the USA. And so I had, you know, about, I think it was about five or six different linguists working on it. And we would have these Zoom meetings, you know, where we'd be discussing certain data things that they weren't sure what they should, you know, how they're checking POS tagging and they weren't sure what this should be or what that should be. And all the POS tags are important because they feed into other algorithms. And one of the guys said, you know, this is what I thought grad school was going to be like, where we sat and we discussed things. We just wanted to know what the truth was. Nobody was trying to look smart. Nobody was trying to force anyone else to believe it should be their way. We were just trying to, you know, understand the data this way. And I thought, wow, what a blessing. You know, what a great thing.
Yeah, the highest compliment for sure.
Yes.
I was saying to you before we got started that in the business of the linguistics career launch, we have quite a few students who are very interested in forensic linguistics. And I think from talking to them, they are very motivated by the moral aspect of it. And some folks have indeed done some work for like the Innocence Project. But we also have heard that the programs, like if you wanted to get a degree, a PhD in linguistics, and you were trying to do forensic linguistics, it's not what you think it is. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, you're a student, this is the thing that really jazzes you, you want to do it. What should you do? Like, what's the path?
Okay, so this is the, I'll give you plan A and plan B.
Awesome.
Plan A is what I have told people for decades, and that is, get your PhD in linguistics in one of the core fields. And by that, I mean like phonology, syntax, formal semantics, computational linguistics, psycholinguistics, okay? So I don't include sociolinguistics because sociolinguistics, the tool set will mostly get you at group level things. And that's not what you need to do at a lot of forensic things. You know? John Ball and I have talked about this too, and he has said the same thing. You know, like he immediately understood what I meant. He goes, "Yeah, you'll figure that they belong to this group, but guess what? That poor defendant, just because they belong to that group, doesn't mean he's the only person in the group."
Right. The group hasn't been accused of a crime. It's the individual.
Yeah, only this poor one guy. You know? And then I said, and then I would say, get your, you know, so get, so that's so that you really have a backup plan. Okay. If you're in one of these core fields and you really have a good skill set, you know what to do. So then the second thing is try to find a dissertation topic that has some kind of forensic use or connection. Mm-hmm. So one of my former mentees, you know, went to Georgetown. He ended up majoring in computational linguistics there. And he did a whole lot of work on with a semanticist. He did a lot of work on, you know, spatial language. And it turned out it was really useful with regard to serial killers.
Mm, wow.
Yeah. So one of my postdocs, because the Institute has had postdocs in Spain, she did her dissertation work in corpus and computational linguistics, and she worked on deceptive language. And so that's very useful with regard to interrogation and interviewing. So that's plan A. I usually tell people do not go get a degree in forensic linguistics because, and I'm not the only one who has said this, Larry Solin, who's passed away last year, but he was a professor of law and he was also a PhD in linguistics. He said the problem with these forensic linguistics degrees is that they don't teach any of the core fields in linguistics. So they're almost all discourse analysis degrees. And they're like critical discourse analysis, which is really rhetoric. You know, with critical discourse analysis, you know, Norman Fairclough stuff, that came out of rhetoric. That didn't come out of linguistics. So it's not very, you know, it doesn't give people the kinds of things they need to know. I mean, I've had read reports where people didn't know the difference between a predicative and an attributive adjective. And they had PhDs in linguistics. Mm-hmm. You know, that's scary. I had one girl from Australia trying to, you know, seek training with me, but she couldn't tell the difference between a verb phrase and a clause. And so when you really need these core fields, you know, to do good, strong linguistic analysis. All right. So obviously my opinion about forensic linguistics degrees is not popular, but I'm not alone. You know, I mean, and other people have said, whoa, wait a minute. You know, you got to be a good linguist. Even Roger Shai has said for years, you need to be a good linguist first. So that's why, that's the idea behind plan A. But plan B, okay, is something that I'm working on with a university, and it's in such nascent stage that I won't say much about it. But the idea there is, what about if you have a degree in forensic linguistic evidence, where you already have good training in linguistics, but you really need to understand linguistics as a forensic science, you know, so the rest of it. Or another degree thing I'm thinking about is forensic linguistic technology, which is where you learn how to use the technical things that are available, like the software I've developed. You learn how to compare the software I've developed with other software that's out there. You learn how to test these kinds of things. You don't really need to be a linguist to do that. So that's good for people who aren't linguists who, you know, want to get into the field and basically, you know, run people's tools. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are plan A and plan B.
And I think the big question that people always ask is, you know, can this be a career? Can you make a living doing this?
Yes. I mean, I think you have to, I know that, okay, one of the issues, I had when I first got started in this, and I was a professor, I was an assistant professor, I have to be sure to say that because I wasn't tenured, but I didn't see how I could do this work at the same time that I was working as a professor. Number one was double dipping. I mean, most of the professors who do this run their from their consulting gigs right out of their offices.
Mm-hmm.
And the universities don't mind.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some universities that really have a limit on it and put a cap on it. Cornell is one that will not let their professors serve as expert consultants over a certain amount. But most of them are just fine with it. And the other problem with that is that the people who actually do the work are not the professors. The professors get their graduate students to do mm-hmm. the work. And,
yeah.
and then that's the problem, because the attorney is hiring this guy because he's got all these academic credentials, but who's really doing the work is a person who doesn't have any of those academic mm-hmm. credentials. Mm-hmm. So that's a moral issue for me too. So I just decided, well, I think this is going to be really fun to do. And I think this is a great answer to not staying in academe. So I just jumped in and said, that's what I'm going to do. You know, and I spent the first 3 years at NIJ. And then I spent some other time, you know, I taught criminal justice at a community college for a while. And then I just committed myself to doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done it.
Yeah.
So I do think it's possible. I mean, I think that the field, in a way, could be at a crossroads, that if it continues to produce junk science, that will destroy the field.
Mm-hmm.
And it also hurts linguistics. Really hurts linguistics mm-hmm. a lot, you know, because lawyers will say things like, oh, yeah, you know, I've read that guy's stuff. It's voodoo.
Yeah.
Whoa. You know? So one of the functions I have served in the field is the person who says, yeah, that is voodoo. That's not linguistics, you know, or yep. When you have software that claims it's 77% accurate on 10,000 words per author, and then you apply it to documents that maybe add up to 1,000 words, you can't really say that 77% is going to hold.
Mm-hmm.
That 77% is going to be a lot less.
Yeah.
You know, making those kinds of arguments about what people do in the field. And again, you know, that has not been a popular place to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if somebody doesn't do it, the field will just go down in history as, you know, junk science that eventually truth caught up with it, you know, or that linguistics became a laughingstock.
Yeah. I like that turn of phrase you just used there, that the truth caught up with it. I feel very frustrated listening to you talking about this, because as a linguist myself, you know,
yes.
I can see the possibility. Like, you can see where a linguist with validated data methods like you've done can make a huge difference, right? And you see, you know, just reading about cases where there are so many places where a linguist could come in. You need a linguist for that, and actually yep. clarify things and make it understandable or correct a misapprehension that people have. But to see not to overstate it, the flood of crap yep. that gets put up as actual linguistics in court cases or that the police rely on is really disheartening, right? Like, you see how good it could be, but then you see what's actually happening and it's like, what can we do to fix this? I don't know.
Well, one thing is just plodding along, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing that's really important, I think, is to explain that, you know, this is not a glamorous field.
Mm-hmm.
My first case was on forensic files.
Mm,
it's called
interesting.
It's called Letter Perfect. It's really a great. They did a fantastic job.
I love forensic files.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was done in like 2003, I think. And you know, one of the best things about that show, you know, is it shows an early version of Alias running, you know, and the narrator goes, it looks at every word.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. You know, that's good, because the garbage stuff just looks at the words it wants to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important, you know, that that narrator, you know, that guy recognized that, you know, a real method would look at every word.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't just look at what I think is fun.
Yeah.
You know, what pops out at me. That's not science.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is just plodding along, you know. And I do feel that I get, gosh, I get these emails from students, you know, and the one type is, I really want to be a forensic linguist, you know, and I really want to do this. And then I talk to them about plan A, and then they're like, I don't want to go to school. I don't want to do that. You know, well, that's kind of what it really takes, you know, and, or well, can't I just go and get this criminology degree where they say I can do a focus on forensic linguistics, you know, or can I say I'm a forensic linguist if I take one undergraduate course or one graduate course in it? That's what a lot of academic, you know, places are doing.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I'm trying to set up with this other, you know, with this university, something different.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the takeaway I'm hearing is that if you want to do forensic linguistics, you got to be a linguist first.
Yes.
Like just a linguist, and you have to have a specialty and you have to be an expert. Yes. And then the forensic and criminology stuff comes later.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that we should be training people in that right away, you know, because I think that's one of the problems with the field is that the idea of trust the expert is still very dominant. And so you get the idea of, you know, like you get people in the field who they're always playing up their role, you know, or they're always playing up, you know, how glamorous their life is, you know, or what they've built and all this stuff. And the problem is that if it's that way, they're not really doing methods that take a while to run.
Yeah. It's like when you see, in cases that are very high profile, and they'll have an expert come in and it's like celebrity coroner.
Yes.
It's like, that shouldn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
That shouldn't be a thing.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yes. Right. So I also get emails from students who have been trained in some of these forensic linguistics degree programs, and they're begging me. They want to come work for me. And not only that, they are sure that they can help me with authorship ID. And I just about think, wow, that's astounding. They got through that whole degree and they never read the literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, ill-prepared.
They're ill-prepared, you know? I mean, they haven't even read the literature. They don't even, they're almost like sitting ducks.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to explain to some people just want to get a master's in it, and then I keep explaining to them, but you're going to be up against people who have PhDs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And this is another thing that I get asked a lot too, is do I need a PhD? And yeah. I think you've made the case really clearly that for this particular aspect of applied linguistics, having a PhD is important for a lot of reasons. But that what you just said also is extremely important, because you're going to be put up there, and it's not about the tenure or anything else. It's just you have to look like an expert, and the PhD is what makes you the expert there.
Yeah. Even though you probably learned more linguistics in your master's program than you do in a PhD program, which includes a master's, you know what I mean? Because once you get your master's, you're really kind of like doing your own thing. Not taking as many courses, you know, not studying a whole bunch of other stuff. But even so, nobody knows that outside of academe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the PhD just holds more weight.
Exactly.
And people want to, you know, like when I try to explain this to some students, I'm like, you won't even get hired.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, exactly.
I'm sorry, but they're not going to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, everybody, actually, all of us, including myself, you have to just go your path in order to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So even if somebody tells you, oh, this is going to be hard, you know, or, this might not work out. You're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. So I have learned that, you know, with students who contact me, I just sometimes have to just let them do their own thing, you know, and I feel sorry about it because I try to warn them, and it's so expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Right. But that's why I'm really hoping I can set up this other kind of, I hope I can set up plan B, you know, because plan B is really a way to solve some of these problems we've talked about.
Yeah, it sounds super interesting. And maybe future, when it gets more set up, you can come back and you can talk about it, because I think people would love to hear about that.
I would love that.
Yeah. So let's wrap this up on a hopeful note that there is a space. But I think this whole conversation has just been fascinating. And I think people will really get a feel for what this all entails. And also, like, as I said, I felt so many emotions as we've been talking about this, knowing that more than any other aspect of linguistics, this particular application of it has real world consequences, and they can be literally life or death for people. And that's why we need to take it seriously and treat it like the sacred thing that it is, right?
Yes.
Like you can't view it as just a fun thing that you do on the side.
That's so true. And really, there is a type of personality that you need, and that you really do need to like helping people.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause by the time people get to the forensic linguist, you know, that means they've really been through the ringer.
Yeah.
And they, a lot of times, you know, I get called by private individuals because the police don't even want to help them anymore.
Yeah.
And you have to talk to the police and explain why this could be useful and that kind of thing. So it is really important to have kind of a heart of service,
mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm,
and usability. You know, I know that that's not a popular concept, especially in theoretical academe, you know, where it's almost like being useful is like looked down upon. But if you really like to be useful, mm-hmm, and you really don't mind being used, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. I really like that. And I like that phrase, heart of service. That's beautiful. Is it okay if we put your LinkedIn profile in the notes and for people to ping you if they've got questions?
Yeah. I can tell you, I have one more other thing to say. And that
sure.
is, you know, we have talked about how it's hard to be, you know, the odd person saying what people don't want to hear. It's odd. It's hard to be ostracized, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? This path for me has been a real blessing.
Mm-hmm.
It's been just wonderful to work on the cases I've worked on, to work with the people that I've worked with. It's really a blessing to be able to use something you really love in a way that does help people.
Mm-hmm.
I was teaching at the Linguistics Institute one summer, and the two directors said to me, "Why are you doing this?" And I said, "You know, this is going to sound really corny, but I love linguistics.
Uh-huh.
I love analytical techniques. And this is a way to use them in service to people. And what better can you ask for, you know?"
Absolutely.
Really blessed.
No, I agree. Could not agree more with that. That is great. Mm-hmm. Well, let's leave it there. Carol, thank you so much for taking all this time. We went way over the time that I budgeted.
Know.
So thanks for sticking with me. This has been so good. And I look forward to having you back maybe when you've got your plan B set up.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Laurel. It's great talking to you.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.